As we've been thinking about the God story recently, we've talked about how that God story ripples out from us and happens all around the city as we have these gathering places. Sometimes we're just two or three gathered together, and that miracle that God is at work, it happens in that place, in that interaction, in that community that is created. We've also all over the years talked about how we are ascending church, how people from here have gone out to other places and sometimes return to us, sometimes return for a season, sometimes come back on a long-term basis. But one of those people that has been sent out from here is the Burdick family. Years ago, Tim and Heather were here. In fact, they were married in this church a number of years ago. I don't know how many. 20 years. Wow, congratulations. And they have gone out, Tim in pursuing his PhD, and then he was called to McKinley Hill in Tacoma and pastored there and has gone on to do other things, and God has led in that. But then periodically comes back because you really are part of us. Whether you like it or not, we're owning you all the way through. And Tim has felt led to join YQ, which is Youth and Young at Heart, challenged to expand their worldview, and are going to Bolivia this summer. And he's going to come and share with us. He says he'll introduce a little more about himself for those of you that have never met Tim before, as and refresh for the rest of us what's going on and what he's up to, and kind of his story about why he's going to Bolivia. I'm excited because I spent a year in Bolivia, so I'm real excited to hear about it too when you come back. We'll have him back to share the story of what happened. We are excited to have this God story expressed. Thanks. Come, Tim, and share with us.
Well, thanks for having me this morning. I don't know if you've been ever on a journey for a while and you've come back to your house and there's a sense of, you walk in your front door, it's like, this is home. And that's kind of what I feel like every time I walk in the front door here. It's like, this is home. This is a place where I grew up. And so thank you for having me. I was realizing as on the drive in this morning that it's been about 2.5 years since I was up here. And at the time, I was fresh off finishing my doctorate. And I was looking for places to get my dissertation published. I was looking for long-term permanent employment. And I can say that now after 2.5 years, it's pretty much the same. God has been really faithful with a lot of short-term, temporary, fill-in, adjunct positions, but still that elusive permanent position is out there, and that's okay. I think God works in mysterious ways sometimes, and so that door has yet to be opened for me. For those who don't know me, it might be good to start with a little bit about how I became a Quaker in the first place. I grew up as kind of a non-denominational mutt. My family didn't go to church when I was really young. Started attending church when I was a teenager. Went off to college. And historically, amongst friends, there's been two ways that people have come into the society. One is through being a birthright Quaker. You were born into the religious society of friends. Heather is a birthright Quaker. And I know some of you might be birthright Quakers. And there was a period in our time when that was actually the only way you could become a member of the society. And still today, even though we've gone away from that tradition, I think that's cherished. And people who are birthright Quakers have a really special and revered place. The other way is through convincement, and that's you look at the society's testaments, their theology, or their lack of theology sometimes. You look at the beliefs that they have. You look at the way that the people who adhere to this faith live their lives, and you're like, wow, I'm convinced. I want to be part of that. I think I found a third way for me. And that was when I was in college, there was this girl that was beautiful and kind And whatever religion she had was good enough for me. And so we started attending here. And as Lorraine said, we were married right up there. And at first, friends for me was kind of this thing that was just something along the Protestant continuum. It was the church that I attended. It wasn't necessarily something that I owned. And so I was here for a few years, and finally I felt like I wanted to become a part of the community, an official part of the community. So I became a member after about 2-3 years, and I remember that day because it was the same day they needed somebody to be clerk of the trustees. So the same day I became a member of the church, I became clerk of the trustees, which I kind of thought was odd until I realized, you know, that's just kind of how we do it sometimes. We spent 13 years here, at least 13 years here. We served on, I think, every committee the church has. And it was a time that we cherish. And again, this feels like home for us. By the time Sierra was born, I felt like it was time for me to make some transitions in my life. It was one of those things where I think I knew something was going to happen, but I had no idea what that was. God kind of works that way sometimes. Like, gives you these intuitions, these leadings, these nudges, but you have no idea, other than taking the next step, what it's going to look like after that. And so I did some things that, in one sense, don't make a lot of sense. I quit a full-time job, a nice permanent salaried high position in social service, and decided I was going to take a season of my life and just listen and see what God had next. We were led down to McKinley Hill Friends Church, where I was bivocational pastor for several years down there. And in that time, I also started getting a PhD in Quaker Studies. So you can see full circle, the non-denominational mutt who was just attending because he was interested in a girl, now is a scholar and an adherent and a devoted member of the Religious Society of Friends. I finished up my PhD in Quaker Studies in 2013. And in some ways, I feel like I have made the rounds of the Puget Sound churches. Aside from here and McKinley Hill, I spent a year doing pulpit fill at Olympic View Friends. I've occasionally filled in for Pastor Paul Meyer at East Hill. And so in some ways, it's nice to feel like the entire group of churches around here is a place of safety and a place of home. Last summer, I went on a mission trip to Brazil. I'm going to share a little bit about that, as well as this coming summer I'll get a chance to go on a mission trip to Bolivia. And I'm going to weave some of that into the story here. And some of this has several kind of the way God works, several tangential components that kind of all come together eventually. But let's start with prayer, if you would pray with me. Lord, these words are offered provisionally. Provisionally in the sense that it's going to take your grace to translate them into whatever message needs to be heard today on an individual basis. So I would simply ask that you come, sit next to us, sit beside us, and whisper into our ear the message that needs to be heard. For each of us, that is different, and that's the great thing about how you work. Is one thing can be spoken, but what we hear is exactly what you need for us to hear. Be with us as we share and as we worship and as we listen. Amen. I think one of the things that I've come to realize in the last decade or so is that God works in really bizarre, funny ways. I tend to be pretty linear in my mind. Patty mentioned the engineer who comes on Monday. That's kind of my way of thinking about things. I like to know what's going to be laid out. And God doesn't really work that way. In fact, sometimes the answers are entirely unexpected. Sometimes you need to take a step in one direction only for the truth of that step to reveal that you need to take a step in an entirely different direction. And then in turn, by being faithful and taking that step, the truth is revealed of another step in a different direction. And sometimes things are really topsy-turvy. Like sometimes the answer comes at a strange, strange time. And for me, I think I had been trying to answer a question that I didn't know I was even asking. In fact, I didn't know I was even asking it until recently. even though I feel like I've been trying to answer it for the last 10 years. And to put this in context, what really brought this home for me was a sermon that I heard. So the church that we've been attending has been doing this series, the sermon series, on why people don't go to church. And you get all the usual answers. Church isn't fun, church is too much dogma, church is about rules, do this, do that. The final sermon in the series, the person who was bringing the message said that sometimes people don't go to church because the statements, the belief that they have is simply this: your God is irrelevant to me. Your God is irrelevant to me. Now, when I hear that, I get a little defensive. I'm like, well, wait a minute here. How could that be? And in one sense, I kind of feel like I'd get a little bit onto a theological soapbox. I want to start defending God. And I want to start introducing all sorts of ways and reasons that God is relevant into our world. And I realize they're not actually saying what they're saying. I know the statement is, your God is irrelevant to me, but what's really sad is it struck me, and it struck me painfully hard, is the only way that statement can be true is if what they're really meaning is you are irrelevant to me. It's actually not a theological statement. They're actually not saying your God is irrelevant to me. What they're saying is you are irrelevant to my daily life. And that strikes a pretty tough chord for me. If you look at the word relevant in its Latin root, there's two parts of it: re, again, and levo, which is lift or to raise up. So there's this idea with relevancy that you are coming to lift alongside, to make their burden lighter. And the really cool part is you're doing it again, as if you have been there so many times already. You're relevant because your presence is there to aid in a way, as if saying, wow, you've been here so many times before. And so when I hear that statement, your God is irrelevant to me, I think what the statement is, the church, you, as members of the church, are not always there beside us, ready to lift. In fact, if you looked at many of the Jesus' parables, in many ways they seem like an indictment against the Pharisees and how relevant they were to their society. Story of the Good Samaritan. Who is my neighbor? Well, the one who comes and lifts the broken, near-dead stranger out of the ditch and lifts them onto their own beast and gives their own aid. So relevancy is about service. And I should clarify, I don't think we're being asked in any way to make our theology relevant in a sense that waters it down. In fact, I'm convinced that when people look at the church and they see them watering down their theology in a way to make it kind of more trendy, postmodern, or post-postmodern, whatever era we're in now, I think they see through that. I tend to be one, I have a pretty conservative theology, but a pretty liberal social outlook. And my sense is that that's where the rubber meets the road, is in service. When we make our Christianity relevant to the world, I think it's when we show up and we're ready to work. Maybe this isn't the best analogy for a pacifist to use, but there's always those times in the movie when things seem really dark and, you know, everything's lost, and maybe the battle scene's being torn apart and people are near the end, and suddenly over the hill comes charging the cavalry. And you kind of know, like, wow, they're going to save the day. Wouldn't that be cool if people thought of the church that way? It's like when everything seems lost, when people are at their darkest moment, and suddenly they look up and they're like, wow, here comes the church again. They're relevant because they're coming again to aid us. One of the benefits of having written 425 pages in a dissertation is you're kind of set on sermons for the rest of your life. So I want to take us back a little bit in history here, about 100 years, to the turn of the last century. And I want to take us back to a time when in America, the country was going through some pretty rampant change. Up until that point, really kind of up until probably the Civil War, America was primarily rural, agrarian society. The idea of a megacity just didn't exist. But after the Civil War in America, society changed, and it changed quickly. It went from primarily small town, you pretty much stayed and lived in the same place where you grew up, to one of capitalism, urbanization, and industrialization. Between 1860 and 1920, our nation's population tripled. The number of businesses, licensed businesses, increased eightfold. And the net national product increased 30 times larger. So this was a boom economy. Probably not dissimilar to other boom economies we have, but it went on for 40, 50 years with very few bumps in the road. People were leaving their small towns, their farms. They were moving to the cities. The modern day idea of the factory was born during this time. The railroad, you can almost think of the railroad as perhaps how we think of as the internet, as far as its influence on life. Suddenly people were able to move faster than they'd ever moved before. And the idea of going cross country was like, wow, we can do that in just a short time now. Industries were born, many industries are still around today. The free market system kind of started to stretch its legs and really come into play. Unfortunately, in this time, it wasn't really a situation of a rising tide raises all ships. It was kind of more, there were a few capitalists, a few entrepreneurs, a few people who were getting extremely wealthy, and then there was everybody else. Maybe we could think of this as the modern day equivalent of the 99% and the 1%ers. And so as people were moving into the cities, well, the cities weren't always great places to live. And as you might expect, social problems arose all over the place. Increase in squalor, crime, very few educational opportunities unless you had a lot of money. Very few labor laws, even for children. In fact, we have to get almost into the 1920s before we find the first widespread national child labor law in our country. There were some that were state by state. But really, working conditions, unless you were one of the wealthy, were pretty bad. Social problems were rampant. Crime was pretty prolific in the city. It wasn't a safe place to stay. And there was one institution. There was one institution that kind of stepped in and filled this gap. I'm not sure if you've been to Europe and seen the trains where they always have those signs that say, mind the gap. And whenever I see that, I kind of think, what's the gap in our world that we should be mindful of? Well, I think the church saw this gap between this incredible wealth on one sense and this deprivation and degradation of humanity in the other sense. And so the church itself stepped in. This was before like Roosevelt and the New Deal platform. So before the government was really looked at to be a social institution. The church came in and said, we're going to be relevant to our world. We're going to be relevant to our world. And so pastors, believe it or not, left their pulpits and started running for political office. People in the churches became teachers, doctors, lawyers, dentists, nurses, social workers. This idea became the heart and the soul and the mission of the church, was that they were going to integrate themselves into society to such an extent that they were literally ushering in the kingdom of God. A very post-millennial mindset. But this idea that, yeah, individual redemption is important, and we can never move away from that, but there are so many structural, systemic sins that keep people oppressed, that keep our society down, that need to be addressed in a way that Jesus would address. And so the church became the champion of social causes. Optimism, I think, at that time, pre-First World War, was pretty high. And the optimism was simply that we are going to radically change this world. We are going to be in the world, even if we're not of the world. We are going to be in the world, getting dirty and muddy and working alongside. So what happened? What happened? I mean, most of us can look around the world today and say, I don't know if that ever happened. There's nothing about the kingdom of God that feels like it's been ushered in very well. In fact, we could probably make a case that things got a little worse, have gotten a little worse. And probably most of us would say that today, when those kind of needs are present, not everybody, but a vast majority of people don't look to the church. They don't look to the church to fill that gap. In fact, the church kind of has lost its monopoly on social issues. Well, what happened? Sadly, what happened is the church itself shut itself down. See, not everybody was enamored with this new social programs of the church. Not everybody thought that going out and offering a cup of cold water was such a good idea. In fact, there was such concern following the First World War that social programs were tied to this kind of theological liberalism that most Protestant churches started to divide. And in one denomination after another in America, including Friends, you can go back to the 1920s and 1930s and see where one became two. One denomination became two. It's actually today how we have Friends United meeting in Evangelical French Church. One becomes two. And it was mostly over this issue of dogma, doctrine, trying to preserve that as sacred, and service. Well, it's right during the heart of these debates, 1930s, that our yearly meeting, then known as Oregon Yearly Meeting, in the year 1930, agrees to take over this small fledgling mission in La Paz, Bolivia. It was a mission mostly to the Aymara Indians, who were indigenous to the area. At the time, it consisted of just one monthly meeting, a small Bible training school, a night school, a small medical department, and mostly the yearly meeting decided to take it over because theologically they felt like there was a whole new place to venture out and save souls. And the yearly meeting's motives seemed to be pretty pure, but that first decade, everything about the service that they did is just ripe with this same tension that's going on in all of Christianity during that time. And our yearly meeting, which kind of fell more on the side that preserving doctrine was more important than doing social work, focused entirely on that the first decade in Bolivia. They went out, and they were pretty impressive. They had tracks that they put through all the mountainside homes. They had revivalist meetings. They tried to save souls. In fact, there's usually in the yearly meeting records, you can see a count from year to year, the number of new souls that were justified, sanctified, and I keep waiting for them to add, like, petrified or something. But they kept track of these things because it was really important to them how many people that they were saving. But they missed an opportunity. At least I think they missed an opportunity, because the Ayamari Indians in Bolivia were an oppressed people. They were essentially, in the same way that in America the Native Americans were treated by European conquerors, they were, in a sense, the people who were conquered by Spanish conquerors. And so they were treated like slaves in their own land. No rights, no privileges. And sadly, you don't see the yearly meeting doing anything outside of trying to save souls to fix this. Even the services that they offered. So they offered education, remedial education, and medical services. And I think this is really sad. Those services you could not get unless you accepted Jesus Christ as your personal Lord and Savior first. Now, theologically, maybe that makes sense if you're concerned about doctrine. But I don't see that anywhere in the Bible. I never have read anything about Jesus asking, well, show me your membership card before I do this miracle. It doesn't work that way. So outside of evangelism, nothing was really accomplished. Some souls were saved. And that's good news. That is the good news. But there were so many places where there could have been intervention, and there just wasn't. From 1932 to 1935, Bolivia and Paraguay were in a brutal, brutal war with each other, primarily over competing oil interests in the areas. And here we are, pacifist, you know? Pacifist in the country during the middle of a war, and there's nothing done to help end that conflict. After the conflict, there's nothing done in rebuilding. But the only thing that you can find is initial efforts to help out the people who were already saved. And again, I think this is just such a sad missed opportunity. You can almost hear the echo kind of reverberating off the Andes. You're irrelevant to us. You've come down here with your doctrine and with your salvation, and we're dying. And you're irrelevant to us. So that first decade was maybe one of those missteps. In the 1940s, though, there was a course correction. God is good, right? God is faithful. And I think even perhaps sometimes in my own life, when I start off in the wrong direction, God finds ways to bring me back on course that are so graceful and so kind and far more generous than I deserve. And so I think God provided the yearly meeting with a course correction in the 1940s. Some of that was due to personnel changes. Some of that was due to pragmatics. Some of that was actually due to what was happening here in the United States in Protestantism and some of the renewal that was coming up in evangelical circles about looking at social ethics as an important part of your mission work. And so in 1940s, the yearly meeting decided to rethink the mission down there. And they had originally envisioned this independent Bolivian French church that was empowered to essentially work on their own, to help their own people, to go out to the mountainside and to, yes, save souls, but also provide these services. And that wasn't happening. And so in the 1940s, the yearly meeting completely restructured the mission work down there. Our superintendent at the time went down there for a lengthy visit, and they introduced a new mission board that was almost entirely made up of Aymara Indians. Go think, right? They made the entire mission responsible for and by and through the locals. And so they had far greater freedom, and the indigenous leaders, to operate as a unified national church. So that's kind of a bureaucratic structure, but it wasn't just like the Yiming did that and then walked away. They also started to recognize this idea that if we're ever going to win souls, we probably need to also put some food on their plate, right? Pretty pragmatic and pretty simple. It kind of works that way. So they started to look for ways to make for self-sufficiency within, self-sufficiency like in a very agrarian sort of way within the local groups. So 1947, the yearly meeting actually bought the farm. If you've been around the yearly meeting very long, you'll remember this as kind of a poignant year in our yearly meeting, kind of a changing time, because there was this symbolic transfer and shift in the Bolivian Friend and Mission. And I think it was a symbolic shift in our entire yearly meeting about the way we look at the world and our relationship to it. But the yearly meeting bought a 300-acre farm just outside of La Paz. And it was entirely set up for sustenance, for helping with food, helping with, and the yearly meeting actually helped with kind of to mechanize some of the practices down there. And there's actually reports in our own yearly meeting minutes about crop yields and the best thing for that environment. And it's neat to see the yearly meeting kind of get invested in some of these fairly pragmatic things. Along with the farm, included in that sale price, there were 33 families sold to the yearly meeting with that sale price. Aymara Indians, again, no rights in their own country. This is where we get the term peons from. They were called peons. So basically 146 persons were bought by the yearly meeting. And the yearly meeting immediately started on this process of freeing them, going through all the legal maneuverings and the steps that had to be taken for that, and in a sense, kind of dysregulating the social injustice that's down there. I think that's an awesome story, because I think as a Quaker, as a Christian, as someone who's really interested in kind of merging theology and social justice, I see that in action, in that discernment. And as I was writing my dissertation and reading through some of these notes, and I am up to this point pretty frustrated with the yearly meeting. And when I get to this point, in the library down at George Fox, I go, woohoo! Like, they got it! They got it! That doesn't mean everything was perfect after that. But in 1952, finally, after almost 2+ decades of struggle, the Bolivian Friends Church was set off as its own independent, fully self-managed yearly meeting. Iglesia Nacional Evangelico Los Amigos. And up until 2002, we were sending regular missionaries down there to support them. Not to do it for them, but to support them. And so this is where I'm going. In some ways, how cool is that? You get to write a dissertation. You think, I'm never going to see this place. I'm never going to see these people. I'm never going to see these sites. And suddenly these opportunities just open up. Sometimes being faithful in one direction opens up an opportunity in a different direction. There'll be 11 of us going down there. If you have a bulletin, you could kind of see this motley crew that's been put together. And we're going to a slightly different Bolivia French church than there was in the 1950s. Bolivia, like much of the global south, is exploding with numbers of new Quakers, number of new friends. In fact, if you want to see where our growth is, it's not in traditional strongholds like Britain and the United States. It's places like Bolivia, Kenya. Bolivia is now responsible for 8% of the world's population of Quakers, which puts it third largest, only behind the United States and Kenya. 30,000 friends are in Bolivia. Almost all of them are still Aymara Indians. 200 monthly meetings. How's that? 1930 there was one. Today there's 200. So why am I going? Well, aside from the fact that it just would be kind of cool to see something that I wrote an academic piece on and to have that discovery, I'm going because I still need to answer that call or answer that statement, your God is irrelevant to me. I feel like I need to step into that gap. Last summer, I had the chance to go to Brazil. I wasn't even on my radar screen. Didn't even think about that. That was with a group called Merge Ministries. We went down there with a group of 22 folks to western Brazil, to a town called Rio Branco, and we ran sports camps. We helped build structures. We spent 2 weeks down there. It was so hot. We were told when we got there, there's no running hot water. And I think as an American, that kind of caused a little bit of panic in your mind. But it was so hot, nothing felt better than those cold showers. It's like, oh, this is heaven. And then, you know, it's like 3 shirt days, so you're taking 2 or 3 showers every day. And I kind of thought that might be it for a while. I wasn't looking for much more. I tried to learn a little Portuguese, and I think I learned just enough to not get arrested. And then this opportunity came up. And this is through YQ, Youth Challenge to Expand Their Worldview. Traditionally, it's just been for primarily youth to go, but they've been moving that towards more youth, and I guess we're calling ourselves young at heart. So I'm 43, I can go for young at heart. But for me, there's this desire to make myself, make my Christianity relevant to people. I don't have to go to Bolivia to do that, but I am. It's the door that God's put in front of me, and so I'm going to walk through that. In some ways, this is pretty easy. All we really have to do is be faithful to what we're asked to do, right? So I'm asked to do this. But I also feel like I want to be part of a corporate relevancy. I want to be part of a group that can go down there and kind of a bookend. You know, I know the beginning of the story really well because I've analyzed it and looked at it, and every scrap of archive that's ever been produced on the Bolivian mission I've read. But I want to be able to, maybe not a bookend, but a next step in that process. So all of you go with me in that sense. I take the yearly meeting on this new mission and this new quest. So if you're interested in being a part of that process, in helping with that process, there are some ways that you can help. Some of them are pragmatic. Some of them are beyond pragmatism. But let me start with the pragmatic stuff. We need to raise funds for this trip. It's a reality of sending 11 people down to Bolivia. It costs money. There's flights, lodging. I think we're going to stay with host families for most of the time to cut back on cost. But at the end of the day, the cost per person is about $3,600. Each person is responsible to raise that for themselves. I am not necessarily taking a pretty rigid stance, so I'd love to be able to say that I raised more than that and just it went for the larger group. But if you're interested in helping out financially, that would be a blessing. One way you can do that is just right now, if you'd like to. On the back of this form, there's a half sheet there that talks about how to give. If you want to save a stamp, you can actually fill this out and give this to me today before we leave. Your donation is tax deductible as long as you fill out your name and address there. If you don't want to fill it out today, you can, of course, send this in. I believe, is it okay to also say you could send it through the church? Okay. And at some point in the process, I've been told that there'll be a PayPal link on the yearly meeting website to just make payments online. But we've been discouraged from using that first off because then the yearly meeting gets charged 3%. So not 100% of your money goes to the mission trip. But again, this is a way that if you want to help, this would help get the crew down there. We're not leaving until June 22nd. We'll be down there for 2 weeks. We also need prayer. We need a lot of prayer, actually. And there's several reasons for that. Everyone's currently smiling in this photo. Is everyone smiling? Yeah, everyone's smiling. But I was looking at this photo when it first came out, and I thought, you know what? I don't know anybody on here. And I don't think too many of them know each other. There's a couple people that know each other. Maybe they're spouses, or there's one father-daughter team going. Or friends in the same churches. But we are a group that is spread throughout the entire yearly meeting. I'm the only one from up in this area, but there are folks from Western Oregon, Eastern Oregon, Idaho. So one of the things we need prayer for is that we're going to have a very, very short season to get together and do whatever kind of bonding togetherness needs to be done before we can turn our attention almost immediately to the needs of the people who are going to be serving. As you know, the tough thing about other people is other people, right? And so we're going to have to kind of figure out that piece and navigate that as we go along. So we can definitely use some prayer that we'll be able to, if we have to set aside issues, if we have to kind of get to know people, if we're just, we show up ready and willing to work. The other thing is, as far as prayer, we don't actually have any idea what we're going to do. So a lot of times mission trips, in fact, this was true on my mission trip last summer. Americans like to know what they're going to do, right? And so we kind of have things planned out. And so last summer when I went to Brazil, we knew which day we were going to be at which site. We knew which task. We actually had pre-divided up our teams. We actually had shipped down, in addition to all of us, we shipped down all the tools and the gear for the sports camps, and everything was set up right to the minute. And that's kind of how we do missions. In fact, if there's any great testament to American mission work in Latin America, it's these half-built structures all over. Because we get down there and we kind of start and we want to do something and we get going. And then we realize the ebb and flow of life, and that just doesn't happen, right? We don't have any idea what we're going to do. It's kind of Quakerly, isn't it? Yeah, we're going to let God reveal to us. We know some places we're going to be, and obviously the people know we're coming. But we don't necessarily have it laid out. So you could pray that God will use us in a way that was wholly unexpected. This has kind of been my journey, right? Allowing for God to use me in a way that's unexpected. So you could pray that God will use our group in a way that's like, wow, we didn't have any plans, and maybe that was the best thing. Because it gave more room for God to be awesome. Third thing you can pray for, I think it's our tendency sometimes to go on these trips and pray for safety. I don't actually recommend doing that. Not that safety isn't good, but physical safety isn't really what we're after here. Certainly God can provide that, but God causes it to rain upon the righteous and the unrighteous. And you know, we may get hurt. We may get dengue fever. We may have all sorts of crazy things happen, right? And what we want to keep safe is not our physical bodies, but what we want to keep safe is that light of Christ that's within us, so that no matter how bad it gets, no matter what kind of loss we experience, the people will look at us and say, wow, they went through a lot of crap, and you know what? They still showed their light. So that's what I would pray for, that you could help us to keep that peace safe within us. And I suppose the last thing that I would ask is simply that you start that same quest in your own life about relevancy. Ask yourself, in what ways are you responding when somebody says, you are not relevant to my life? You don't have to go to Bolivia to answer that. You don't have to go far beyond your backyard to answer that, probably. But where are those places that when you show up, it's kind of like the Calvary's come? People are like, here she comes again. She's been here so many times before, and we know that because she's here, everything's going to be okay. Where are those places where you are relevant in your life? I'll end with this. One of the pastors who went with us last summer to Brazil, I noticed on her back was a tattoo across the entire back of the world. And kind of, I saw that and I thought, theologically, that's a little off, right? Because Jesus is supposed to be hold the weight of the world on his shoulders, right? And so I asked her about it. I said, what's up with the tattoo of the world across your entire back? And she said, it's a reminder that the only way Jesus can carry the weight of the world on his shoulders is through us. through what we do, through the ways that we make ourselves relevant to this world. We're going to enter into a time of open worship here. This is our chance to let God put me aside and talk directly to you, to give to you the message, the words that you need. And I would ask that you just listen. Let that resonate in your heart. And if in time, it's apparent that what God is giving to you is also for the larger communion, then please feel free to share that. Thank you.